In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Hello, everybody. How's the German house doing? Can we get a reaction here? How you doing, boys and girls and everybody in between? It's great that you're sticking around with us for, a very easy and light and easy digestible topic for a relaxed chat in the afternoon. We're talking about cybercrime and defense politics and the technological part of it and what challenges we are facing. Cybercrime is, I don't really have to tell you, it's one of the most dynamically changing criminal phenomena. Perpetrators adapt flexibly to technical and social developments, act globally, and attack where they believe it is financially worthwhile. According to a Bitkom study, 82% of companies were affected by cyber attacks last year, and companies worldwide do not feel secure or properly protected for the future and prepared. So what defense strategies, what kinds are necessary? What are the political basic requirements, and how can different countries and continents learn from each other's strategies to maintain global safety in a digital future? That is what we want to discuss, and we would love you guys to come up front and sit down with us, because this is going to be really, really interesting. And I would love to introduce to you these fantastic people. Daniel Fürk, serial entrepreneur in the media sector with a strong focus on future topics, particularly in the intersection of technology, innovation, and defense, and founder of 48 Forward, where he curates discussions on disruptive technologies, including advancements in the space tech sector with an agenda to prepare companies for the technologic challenges of tomorrow. Give it up for this gentleman, Daniel Fürk. Next to Daniel, we have Robert R. Snake Hansen, Austin local, one of the renowned cybersecurity experts worldwide with a deep background in web application security and penetration testing, co-founder and former CTO of BitDiscovery, which was acquired by Tenable, as former vice president of labs at White Hat Security. He managed to hack into Pentagon too. We're going to have to talk about this. And you were asked to. Throughout his career, Robert has broke into over 2,100 banks and other branches, advising on security strategies for some of the world's largest organizations. And today, Robert is managing director of Grossman Ventures, hosts at the successful R/Snake show, and is the author of the book AI's Best Friend. Great that you're around, Robert. And we have Katrina Salazar on stage. It's great to have you. Investor, CEO, and founder of WeThink, who are developing business strategies for companies worldwide by optimizing talent through data-driven decision-making. Katrina commutes between USA, Argentina, and the south of France, and is familiar with local specifications in different continents when it comes to technological defense strategies. Katrina, thanks for joining us today. So, obviously, the elephant in the room is the Pentagon hack, Robert.
Yeah, so the Pentagon has a program called Hack the Pentagon, where they try to invite security researchers to come in and break into them. And I said no three separate times because I had no interest in doing that whatsoever. Because if you've ever done a bug bounty, they give you like this big of a thing to break into. And I just know myself, because I'm an actual hacker and I like to go around their stupid rules. And so I found a bug and then I got bored and then I found tons of bugs, like all kinds of things that were wrong and, you know, outdated Minecraft servers on the 10th fleet and printers on the public internet and firewalls that aren't even made anymore and all kinds of crap. And so I uploaded that list to them and I basically said, lol, here's all the things you're vulnerable to. And so I was not like a little out of scope. I was wildly, wildly, wildly out of scope. And apparently they almost put me in jail because I went so far out of scope. But fortunately, the Defense Digital Services came to my rescue and said, you can't put this guy in jail for hacking the Pentagon during Hack the Pentagon. And here we are.
When was that at?
See, probably 7-8 years ago now, I guess. The post PS on that is that they now have a new policy that says if you see something wrong, you have to say something and they won't put you in jail. So we actually changed the policies of the Pentagon over that, which was great.
Would you manage to do it again today, or has the system changed in a way that
I feel confident I could get into the Pentagon if I felt like it? Yes.
Okay. Yeah, applause to that. That's confidence. Daniel, if we take a look at the current landscape of cyber threats, like what's happening now, the Federal Office for Security calls the German cybersecurity status alarming or startling. How do you deal with that? Do you agree? Or
I think I would agree. It's especially in Germany, I think we kind of slept for many years in doing the right thing. And especially if you look at cybersecurity and defense topics, we do still have a lot of old systems in place. We are not very agile when it comes to implementing new solutions, maybe safer solutions, more innovative solutions. And we really have to get better in doing that, because all the threats that are coming from outside of Germany are very obvious. We've got cyber attacks from Russia. We have cyber attacks from China. And they are not even trying to hide that anymore. And especially if we look at critical infrastructure, there is a lot of work to do, I would say.
Where is the most work to do? Like what a strategy?
I think it's like a long list, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't know. Robert, where would you start? I have no idea. The list is like...
Well, I would say if you treat the government just like any enterprise, you have the same set of problems with one massive difference, which is that the adversary is sentient and has basically infinite amount of resources compared to breaking into like a retailer or something where they have a finite amount of resources. They're basically just spraying and praying across the internet and they happen to get you. With governments, you really do have to take sort of a different tact. But the four basic principles are: make sure you have some sort of endpoint detection and response. Make sure that you don't have admin consoles sitting on the internet. There's about 3 times more likely to get compromised if you have an admin console on the internet. Make sure that you're fixing all vulnerabilities for which there is known to be current exploitation or previous exploitation, which turns out to only be about 3,000 or so vulnerabilities, not the corpus of 280,000 that are currently in CVSS. And a couple other things kind of similar to that, but basically just more or less hygiene, like knowing what you own and fixing the things that are very obviously going to get you compromised will get you most of the way there. Everything after that is isolation and all this stuff that's unique to the military.
70% of German companies fear threats to their security system, according to like a recent opinion poll by Security Insider. So is it a particular German fear, or is it a bigger problem in Germany than probably maybe, Katrina, you're operating between different continents. Can you describe the difference between like the continents when it comes to their security systems and how they perceive their own fear of cyber threats?
I don't know that I would say it's a bigger problem across Germany. The sense that I get, it's just at Munich Security Conference, the sense that I get is that it's a growing threat across continents and countries. And I think I just wanted to add something from the risk factor side of things. I think our biggest risk is really human at the end of the day. And we oftentimes in our current and ever progressing technologies and systems forget that human factor, both from the organizational or even sovereign level in terms of developing trust, which is one way that you begin to mitigate insurgent threats in individuals. My focus has always been on optimizing that human element alongside of AI and technology. And I think that that's the biggest way that we can begin to mitigate threat is by not forgetting that individual human element, both at the top, and then as we think about training and developing a human component.
But to be honest, I think it's a good thing that companies are afraid, because we're coming from a history where a lot of companies thought that they are not a potential target and they are completely irrelevant to hackers. So we've seen a development where companies are actually seeing that they are all a potential target and they could all be hacked or are interesting for hackers. So I think it's a good thing that so many companies are afraid now, because that kind of leads to action.
Germany had a lot of things happening around the 2003, 2005 timeframe, where a lot of malware was getting introduced and people were getting phished a lot, human element, which caused, I think, Germany to get more interested in anti-phishing technology and anti-malware, antivirus type software. And so I think in generally, if you were to take a population of all of Europe and all of the Americas, Germany is going to be at the top of groups that are more paranoid. Not to say that they're wrong, but they're going to be thinking about it more often than the rest of the countries. That does not mean they're a bigger target. That just means they think about it more often. There is a very interesting paper I actually totally disagree with, but it's by Microsoft, and it's called "So Long and No Thanks for the Externalities: Irrational Rejection of Computer Security," which is to say, if you spend more than a minute a day thinking about security, you're overspending on the amount of liability that you're about to incur. The problem with that is that we're all interconnected. So I meet a lot of people who say that security doesn't affect me because I'd have nothing to worry about. I have nothing to hide or whatever, which means that you can't trust them with security secrets of any kind because they're not taking their security seriously. So while Microsoft's paper is interesting, I think it misses the core fact that we're all interconnected.
So Katrina, you were talking about the different specifications in different countries. Are there any use cases that you can refer to where cybersecurity systems with AI implementation are being used that actually provide a higher security level for companies or probably like security systems?
I think that's probably a better question for Robert, actually, than myself.
Yeah.
Again, I'm focused on that risk mitigation through human optimization. That's a mess across the globe, and in my opinion. So yeah. Going back to what Daniel said earlier about what's interesting about the hackers making themselves present, I think there are two potential reactions. Either we start paying attention to the human element, mm-hmm. or we try and isolate the human element from the technological element and see the human element as a threat. And those are two very different near-term, I think, realities for our future. That's wildly important.
Maybe just to kind of set the scene, I think the most important thing we've got to understand is that it's not about the question if we are at cyber war right now. We do see like a wide range of different sources of attacks from all kinds of countries, all kinds of organizations. So it takes too long to discuss if we are already at cyber war or if we're not.
Mm-hmm.
We need to take action to prevent attacks and to get more secure. So all the kind of diplomatic discussions around if we are at cyber war, how big is the threat, who is the aggressor, and all those topics, it's okay, we can talk about that. But in the end, the danger is already out there, and we do see an increasing number of attacks on all kinds of targets. And if we don't start to really take action in preventing those attacks or in preventing those attacks being successful, then we are going to be lost, to paint a very dark picture here. But I think that's like maybe the most important thing to understand in the first place. And then we have to talk about all the things that need to be done. And there's also a wide range in getting rid of old systems, securing new tech that is implemented, in collaborating with maybe startups that are faster and better, having new technologies, whatever, bringing in experts like Robert, using technologies like yours to also make sure that the human factor is not the thing that is actually in the end the source of danger, so to say.
What about other obstacles like data protection, bureaucracy? In preparation for several talks, it was always a topic that Germany and Europe are way behind when it comes to technological implementation to actually prevent, for example, cyber attacks, and to actually move forward when it comes to technological progress because of obstacles and barriers that are like homemade, basically. So what do you think of this? Like, how are we dealing with this here?
Okay, so I think Germany is its own worst enemy in this regard. There's a thousand things you could do better, but if you just wanted to choose one, it's get rid of as much bureaucracy as possible with regard to AI research and security research. Because the problem is what's ending up happening is all the best and brightest are egressing out of the country. There's a couple of different people I know in the FANG industries, and collectively they're putting in somewhere around $1 trillion over the next couple of years in AI infrastructure, just the physical boxes in places, you know, data centers or whatever. And not one dime of that is going to Europe. And the reason for it is because of the bureaucracy. They're very concerned. In fact, some of the guys I know only travel to the UK to go to court, or they only go to Germany to go to court. They don't travel there for any other reason. They're just getting sued. And so what's ending up happening is they're just getting all of their technology out. They're getting all the people who are doing the research out, because the fastest way to stifle innovation is to put censorship in front of it, which is kind of mandated by things like GDPR and Right to be Forgotten and a bunch of other pieces of legislation that might make sense in a vacuum. But once you start adding on the fact that you're actually in conflict right now and you need to build technology right now for a future battle space, the last thing you want to be doing is saying, no, we don't want someone to be able to look up someone's information in an AI, because it's lobotomizing the future AI and making it much less likely to give you a truth. If you believe that AI is at all capable of being a truth machine, the very last thing you want to do is remove truth from it, no matter how gross it feels to have the truth in it. So
I love that phrasing of removing truth. I think that's a great way to tell the story of why we need some of those data points that we like to fence off to not as much of an extreme as in Europe, but as an AI entrepreneur we are in defense, right? Especially it's one of our biggest hurdles is when we run into the, oh, there's red tape here and bureaucracy here, and it becomes impossible to do the thing you want to do, to get to that truth you want to get to, if you don't have those access points, and you can't just run with the innovation. And running fast with scissors is really important right now.
I mean, I think it's all hands on deck. I mean, if everyone in this room isn't currently working on AI, you're making a mistake. I don't mean like you have to dedicate your life to it, but if you're not actively like trying to push the state of the art forward. Like if you go to Hugging Face today, I checked it the other day, it was like 1.4 million models. 1.4 million models. Like the horse has left the barn. It is now time for us to all embrace this tech, because it is coming for us, not the other way around. Like it is almost an amorphic being on its own that is driven by humans, but ultimately it is starting to assume the way that we are doing business. It is in security, since you asked that question earlier. It's all over the place. It's in media. It's in government. It's everywhere. And so if you're saying it's not allowed to think about a thing, you're basically saying that you're not going to get better at that thing. You're going to be worse. And if Europe is saying, we don't want our point of view to be in those AI models, you're actually dramatically reducing the capabilities of those AI models.
But I would start even way before that, because AI is a very important topic. It's like a part of almost every panel at this conference here. But at the same time, I think, like, especially we in Europe are sometimes, it's unpopular opinion on a panel with Americans mainly, but still, I think we are sometimes kind of naive, because and I'm opening that picture even more now, because if we look at defense spendings, We just had all the discussions in Germany about we need to spend more money on defense tech. We need to buy more. We need to be more resilient to threats around the globe. And then again, we are spending a lot, like a big part of that spendings in the US, which is, you've got great technology over here. That's not the point. But then again, every single fighter jet we are buying in the US is only allowed to fly with a daily software token granted by the US. So if the US is not happy with what we are planning or doing, like I just had a discussion with Denmark, with the ministry there, and they bought a lot of fighter jets from the US. And now they are like, okay, but what if we want to defend Greenland against the US with those fighter jets in like worst case scenario? What are we doing, Dan?
That's fine. You should be thinking like that. Not because we aren't friends, but because who knows what the future will bring. And there's two ways to think about it. There's an enormous amount of cost associated with any new technology if you're going to get it from the ground up. If you have to invent every single microchip from the ground up, all the way through like the way the glass works, all the way through the plastic like injection molding or whatever, you're going to be spending billions and billions and billions of dollars just to get even the simplest like iPhone working, let alone a fighter jet or something, right? Which means you have to make a decision. Either you reduce your costs and outsource that, but there comes a risk, or you balkanize and you bring all of that stuff back in. And so my personal opinion, this is not policy or anything, but my personal opinion is that basically every country that actually cares about its security is going to have to balkanize, which means they're all going to have their own operating systems. They're going to have their own hardware. They're going to have their own software as a services, their own search engines, like any technology, any major technology you can think of, they're going to need a local model for that thing. And that AI model aside, they're going to need a local version of that thing. Otherwise, you're putting your country in dramatic, unnecessary risk.
Because you think it would be an organizational mess to do otherwise?
If you are worried that the US goes rogue, I'm not saying they will, but if you are worried about that, maybe you should have a contingency plan. If all of your hopes and dreams are that we just do the right thing for now and forever and we'll never make a mistake, okay, great. But that's a bet. And then you had better do everything you possibly can to double down on that bet to make sure that we don't do the bad thing. In which case, you're still doing an enormous amount of lobbying and spending to try to keep us in line, or you balkanize.
What about the AI Act, for example?
AI what?
The AI Act in Europe. Do you consider like the legal foundation for dealing with technologies should be balkanized as well and be in the hands of like every nation by itself? Or should there be like a global or like a European act to deal with technology, or a US act to deal with technology? Or
I don't think there's any way around it. I have some friends who do a lot of like deep thinking in this space, and they try to come up with like scenarios where we all get along, and it just like you don't have to try very hard to come up with two groups that just fundamentally hate each other. And as long as that's always true, AI can't take a side, because it's going to piss the other side off. So you're going to have to balkanize AI at some point. Like, I can't have a Chinese model that says the Chinese is great and Xi Jinping is great and also Tiananmen Square, nothing bad ever happened, and have the West exist at the same time. Like, one of those things has to be balkanized and cut off. And same thing with Palestine and Israel. And I could come up with 1,000 other examples of regional conflicts. But you have to decide who is going to be right. And if it's going to be the other side, fine, give them the control, give them all the access to make all these decisions, and you don't need to balkanize. Or if you believe that your side matters, then you have to balkanize, in my opinion.
That, I mean, again, more interesting distinctions on what is the line for where that truth is, right? And what we're willing to fight for or not. And it forces, I think, at the end of the day, for us to ask ourselves, what does it really mean to be fundamentally human and to collaborate? And where does that line exist that allows for some level of collaboration versus ultimately totally balkanizing? And I don't think that there's an answer to that. That has to be a collaborative discussion somewhere. And every sovereign nation has to decide where that line is for them.
Well, Well, I was going to say, in a purely military perspective, as opposed to commercial products, I think the line is much clearer. You know, it's like it's one thing to use Google if you're in Germany. It's quite another to be using, you know, F-16s that might be doing something bad or whatever. But I mean, to be clear, balkanization is already occurring. I mean, Yandex exists, for instance. China has Huawei. The North Koreans have Red Star operating system. I mean, like, there are already regional versions of operating systems, regional search engines, regional technologies, lots of regional military. So this is already occurring. This isn't like a new thing that's just being invented. It's just that now we are seeing greater and greater world fractures, which could mean that we're heading into, God forbid, a war. But it also means that if that bad thing were ever occur, you would want to be thinking about it now, not after the bombs start dropping. You know what I mean?
But just one question to you, Katrina. Someone who provides solutions, for example, to U.S. military right now, if you look into the future of your own company, if we approach that specific topic of like having, building that trust, if you, for example, if you would talk to some European military, maybe the German Bundeswehr, how do you approach that topic? Like, how do you build that trust that some European military is saying like, okay, that's a US company, but they are kind of providing a solution we really want to use. And at the same time, we can rely on that you're not doing anything we don't want you to do with our data in the end.
Yeah, that's difficult. It's something that we have been thinking about. My background is multicultural, so it's strange. I hold multiple citizenships, right? Where does my loyalty ultimately lie, if you want to call it that, or at least identity? So that's a confusing question for I have many friends that could consider themselves global, and it's a really confusing question personally right now. And then it's confusing from a business perspective, like you're suggesting. From the AI model perspective itself, what's fascinating is one of the things that we're doing is looking at cultural differences, because we're building AI for human optimization. One of the things that matters that oftentimes people forget is when you're assessing, you have to take into context the subjectivity that exists between end states that we're projecting. So you have to look at what is the organization's goals in order to train the models that we're training. So when we train a model for the Air Force, we take the Air Force's culture and values and objectives into play. It's their truth, right? And you have to capture that in order to assess the people and optimize pathways for them and for their outcomes. It would be different for the German army or for the Argentinian army, et cetera, because their values and cultures differ. So from a purely technological standpoint, it's actually fascinating.
I mean, that sounds a lot like balkanization.
sure, right? After that, to overcome the business issue of how do we build trust as an organization that could do that across borders, depending on what regulations are in place. I mean, a lot of that's a moving target, quite honestly.
But to draw a bigger picture, like, because we're almost at the end of this panel, doesn't that mean that like the idea of the balkanization is forcing us into our own borders, which is kind of like the opposite of what Europe is, the idea of Europe is, and the idea of like a common ground for how we deal with human concern and threats from like people who are trying to attack peace, or, you know, like a common idea. Is that?
Well, I was just thinking it's kind of the opposite of what we thought technology was going to do, right? Bring us all together and help us collaborate more. We're walking back the other direction here. Go ahead.
I mean, technology is dual use, right? So we have done amazing things I probably would not have met a single person here, or maybe even a single person in the last like 5 years of my life, had it not been for technology. And so technology has done amazing things. It's connected us in ways I would not there'd be no way I would have possibly gotten to where I am. It also is very easily weaponized. And so if you're asking, is it the opposite of what you want? Probably, yeah. that is probably true. You know, in the same way, drinking alcohol is makes you, you know, fun. It also messes up your liver. You know what I mean? It's like things that are great are also bad. And I think what we're now finally experiencing really is the ramifications of being within a few microseconds of our adversaries. And if you allow yourself to be that close, and you have things like roboticized militaries that are dirt cheap, like you could do it with a pocketbook, like I could create massive, massive havoc with very little amount of code and technology. Is that a good thing that technology has enabled? It is a thing that it enabled. I mean, I think that's the right answer. So yeah, it's probably the opposite of what you want, but I don't think that really matters.
Well, to bring in the philosophical aspect here, I think over the last couple of months, we learned that there are different definitions of what it takes to get peace. There are, the current US government has a different definition of that compared to what Europe wants right now, for example. I think what is really important when it comes to our topic here is, if there is one thing that is clear, then that we need more resilience and we need to get rid of all kind of naive approaches. We need to get rid of the idea that peace is given. We need to do something for that. And that doesn't mean that we get into an active fight, but that means that we are at least ready for that. And we in Germany are far from that, to be honest. No matter if you're talking about an actual analog fight or a digital one, like in both areas, we are not ready. And that needs to change. And I think that's the most important message in the end, even for the cyber security and cyber war space. We need to be ready and we need to be resilient and we need to get rid of the naive idea that everything stays as it has been for the last 20 or 50 years.
We all agree on that?
Yes. I think that you, the Germans in the room, if you are not actively telling your ministers or whatever that you need to decrease the amount of bureaucracy, increase spend, and start pulling back as much as possible within your own borders, balkanize, you're doing your country a massive disservice. I'm not saying you should instigate. I'm not saying you should start a war. Make that very, very clear, you guys, you know. But I am saying you should be properly defended. And right now, that is, you're anything but that.
I would like to open this round for the last couple of minutes. If you have any questions, suggestions, please.
The way it feels to me on both sides, and I would love to hear y'all's thoughts, is that the governments don't look at digital borders the same way they look at physical borders. Like, I feel defended if I'm in this country from external attacks. But online, either in the EU or here, I don't feel defended at all. I'm kind of being told that I need to build the walls around my virtual house as if that's it. I'm an island and I need to protect myself from everything. Josh, yeah, do you feel, the question is, do you feel like governments are not taking digital security as seriously as they do border security or whatever you want to call it? Yes or no? What's your perspective there?
Yeah, I would say absolutely they are not treating those things the same, nor can they really without doing stuff that the American public would freak out if they tried to do. We like our freedoms and we treat the internet like we treat like in-person conversations, despite the fact that they're technologically completely different. But there are countries that do treat them quite similarly. Iran has great firewalls similar to China. North Korea is definitely treating the whole thing like a big, you know, like a physical border where you're not allowed to go across it without their allowing it to happen. So it depends on how authoritarian you really want to be and how locked down you want to be as a society. I personally think that that's just a totally non-starter.
Just a follow-up question. Does it actually have to be? Because like all of our frameworks, as an example, the way internet was developed in a lot of frameworks are just totally evolutionary, like organic. So for example, I give my email address to everything. And then if I want them to forget me, I just ask, please kindly just forget my email. But no, there's nothing actually technologically that is guaranteeing that that token has been revoked, like it would be with a credit card, right? With a credit card, I can revoke my payment token, right? And do that. So is there a space for actually enforcing a type of like common infrastructure, just like we have highways, right? We have stuff like that that we build, that we agree to, like, let's use this, right? Is there a space for developing that?
Yeah, I've heard this business model at least three times now from different people. So it's not, you're not the only person who I've heard talk about this. I think it's generally speaking an okay idea where I have a whole bunch of sort of PII that I put into the system, and then I allow companies to purchase a right to use it in my, for however long I want, in whatever way I want. I can revoke it after a period of time. There's some technical challenges there, but the nice part is I get paid. That's like the upside. Like, instead of you just stealing my information and I don't get anything for it, I get paid. But that would need to be backstopped by some sort of legislation. Otherwise, it just wouldn't. They'd do both is basically what ended up happening.
Okay. Any more questions? Because I think we're getting close to the next panel already. And I would invite you guys to have a chat in private after that. And would like to thank you guys to come on stage and for this really interesting perspectives. And I think we have like common opinion here at the end of this panel, which is a great thing. So thank you, Katrina Salazar. This is your applause. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Robert Hansen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel Fuch. And maybe you guys can exchange whatever thoughts you have, and looking forward to see where startups and the US market can be approached by German companies, which is the next panel. So thank you guys for sticking around and have a great one at South by Southwest.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.